On this edition of On Your Money, why you should consider signing up for AARP even if you are younger than 50 years old. Did you know you could do that? Plus, questions you should ask a prospective financial planner about his or her finances, and tips on saving money at the grocery store, plus answers to your personal finance questions. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Our regular financial planner, Kevin McKinley, is off this week, but we are fortunate to have with us a guest fill-in, Roger Ma, who is the founder of the New York City-based financial planning firm, Life Laid Out, and a contributor to Forbes and The Street. If you have a question for him, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Roger Mott joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start off with getting to know you a little better. Earlier this year, you were named one of the Investment News's 40 Under 40. You're 35 years old. You used to work in investment banking. What got you into personal finance?
Yeah, so when I was working those long hours in investment banking, I wasn't so much as interested in the corporate part of finance, but more interested in the personal part of finance. And so that's what got me into starting to write about personal finance and then ultimately becoming a certified financial planner and starting my firm last year.
Mm-hmm. And are most of the people you serve younger people, or do you talk to people who are almost retired like me?
I do a range. So I guess my core are those in their, I'd say, 25 to 45, but I also work with people near retirement as well. A lot of people, when they think about coming to a financial planner, are dealing with some milestone, whether it's getting engaged, getting married, or planning or getting ready to retire.
Yeah, I just say that because I did recently announce that I will be retiring at the end of the month. So I'm.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I am excited.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And I have been a member of AARP for some time now.
Okay.
And as we mentioned earlier, that you signed up for AARP when you as a 35-year-old. I didn't even know that you could do that. Aren't you a little young to be involved with AARP?
I did recently sign up. It's funny. I had always assumed that you had to be 50 or older to sign up for AARP. And then a couple of years ago, I stumbled upon a deals forum where people in their 20s and 30s were debating whether it made sense to sign up for AARP for the deals. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. And so I looked into it, but I didn't pull the trigger then. But recently, I was booking a hotel on Hilton, and I got a rate of 137 or something like that a night. And sometimes when you're booking on the hotel website, you might start venturing to see what other people are paying. So I start to click, oh, what if I had a AAA membership, or what if I was a senior? What would my rate be? And lo and behold, I click on the AARP rate, and the rate is $15 cheaper a night than my Hilton Honors rate. Mm-hmm. And I remembered several years ago that there was this thread where people were debating whether to join. And so I decided to pull the trigger and join.
Yeah, do you just sign up, and do they say that's fine, or do you have to go through any kind of special process as a 35-year-old to join AARP?
There isn't a rigorous screening process. I think a couple years ago, they had a regular membership and an associate membership. A regular membership was for those 50 and older, and you could just join via the website. And I think for those 50 and under, they gave you an associate membership, and you had to call the actual AARP toll-free number. Now what they've done is I think they've consolidated everything into just one membership, and so whether you've met that age threshold or not, you get the standard $16 membership. So all I simply had to do was fill out a couple things online, submit, pay my $16. It took less than 5 minutes.
Yeah, I will confess that I am a member of AARP only through
my husband when he turned 50, I guess I think we're paying a married couple's rate. I'm not sure what it is, but I have a card, but it has his last name on it, which is not my legal last name. So Joyce Starbuck is a member of AARP and has been since Rob Starbuck turned 50. But it is nice. You get the discounts on hotels and at some restaurants, and I know there are many that I don't even take advantage of. What are some of the benefits out there for 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds besides maybe a hotel room?
Right. So the other benefits are, I tested it this weekend. I hadn't been in the movies in a long time, and what the benefit that you get through AARP is to be able to buy these Regal e-premiere movie tickets for $9.50, and they can be used nationwide. And so a movie ticket in Manhattan is over $17. Mm. I was astonished because I hadn't been in a while, but the $9.50 plus there's typically a 50-cent processing fee, and then there's a location surcharge at certain locations, all of them in Manhattan, some in California, and I think in Vegas as well. So that's an additional $1.50. I ended up paying $11.50 for the ticket, but that's still savings of over 30%. Yeah. And then they also have other, what I've learned as I've become a member, is they have other limited time offers that could be pretty applicable to people, whether they're whatever age. And so my wife likes to shop at Lord & Taylor, and so I got this alert that they were selling $50 Lord & Taylor gift cards for 15% off. So I saved $7.50 right off the bat. And then today what they're doing is they're offering 20% off regularly priced items at Walgreens or Duane Reade.
Hey, I have to follow those benefits a little closer. And I don't even remember now. Do the benefits generally outweigh the cost of membership? It used to really be super cheap to join. I don't even know what it is these days.
It is really cheap to join. So it's $16 a year. And then it could be even cheaper if you commit to a 3-year membership or a 5-year membership. I think if you can commit to a 5-year membership, it might be as low as $12 a year. And then, like you mentioned previously, you also get to have a partner or spouse get the membership as well. And so when I joined, I told my wife, Jen, that it was her lucky day because she was going to get a membership card as well. And so to be able to recoup the $12 to $16 isn't that high of a threshold to clear. And so one hotel reservation for me saved me nearly $50, and that more than recouped the $16. And then I saved another $7.50 on the Lord & Taylor gift card, and on the movie tickets, at least $10 because I got two tickets. So, and then who knows how much I'll save today at Walgreens.
Right. I'm going to check it out. Roger Ma is our guest. He is founder of the New York City-based financial planning firm Life Laid Out and a contributor to Forbes and The Street. We are talking with him about our finances. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is off this week. Roger Ma telling us about the benefits for even young people to be members of AARP. What about you? What discounts do you get from AARP? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Or if you have a personal finance question for Roger, that's fair game as well. We have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Some of the most common questions on this program deal with choosing a financial planner, Roger, and you've written a bit on this subject, and you laid out 5 things to look for when picking an advisor. What should we consider when it comes to education and experience?
So first of all, what I'll say is that it can be incredibly confusing to find a financial professional. And I think one of the big reasons is because there's a lack of standardization around terms. Anybody can call themselves a financial coach, financial planner, or financial advisor. And so you might see one person call themselves a financial planner with one set of qualifications, and another person call themselves that as well, but have none of those qualifications. And I think John Oliver had poked fun at this on HBO by printing out a financial planner certificate for himself. Mm-hmm. But to your question on education experience, I think the most important thing is just to get a sense of what is their educational background, and then how many years have they been in the financial services industry, and what makes a particular professional uniquely qualified to serve your needs.
Yeah, there really is an alphabet soup of all the different certifications, too, so it's really hard to... There's the CPA, there's the CFA, there's the AFCs, and I mean, and you're a certified financial planner, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, so what are we to make of all these? Is one, you know, one far superior than the other?
So, yeah, the three main ones I'd say that you see are the CFP, which is the Certified Financial Planner designation, the CFA, which is the Chartered Financial Analyst designation, and then the CPA, which is the Certified Public Accountant. So the Certified Financial Planner is what I am, and that's what some consider the gold standard in financial planning. That gives you a base level of financial planning education in a number of different facets, such as cash and debt management, investments, insurance, and estate planning. And then with each of these certifications, you're required to complete a minimum number of continuing education requirements. And I think the good thing about that is it forces these professionals to stay on top of the latest and greatest strategies. The CFA designation has more of a focus on investments, so investment management or portfolio management. And then the CPA, or Certified Public Accountant certification, has more of a tax focus.
Yeah. Advisors are typically fee-only, commissioned, or a combination of the two. The people that you talked to seem to think that an advisor who charges a flat fee is the best way to go. Why is that?
So I think the reason is because a lot of advisors are charging an assets under management fee, and so as your investment portfolio grows, their fee grows as well. And so if you imagine that you have $1 million portfolio and you're getting charged 1% on that, you might pay $10,000. And then if your portfolio is able to grow to $1.5 million, your fee increases by $5,000 to $15,000, but your situation didn't necessarily become that much more complex for the financial planner. And I think that's why some of the people that I interviewed for the article had suggested flat fees maybe being a little more fair for the consumer than the assets under management fee structure.
Another thing you say we should consider is how often and with whom we will be interacting. As a general rule, what do you consider reasonable for how close our working relationship with our financial advisor be?
I think it really depends on each individual consumer and what they're looking to get from the relationship, but I think it's good to be able to manage expectations from both sides up front. And so I think it's important for a consumer to understand for whoever they're talking to on the initial call, is that the person they're going to be working with on an ongoing basis? Are they going to have a team and interacting with someone else on a day-to-day basis? How often are they going to meet or speak with the financial advisor? Will they have quarterly check-ins, semi-annual check-ins? And then what will be the actual deliverables that the financial advisor will be giving you? Will they be giving you an upfront plan? Will they be giving you a plan helping you with ongoing investments and then also proactive advice throughout the year? I think everyone's situation and needs are different. And so as long as you lay out up front what the expectation is and what your needs are, and make sure those match, I think that's the most important thing.
You wrote another piece that caught our attention. It was about whether we should ask potential advisors about their own personal finances. Should we do this?
I think it's totally fair game. I think when I've talked to some consumers, they've been hesitant to even ask those five basic questions that I laid out, specifically about even how advisors are compensated or how much they make. And I tell them that this is your money. It's important for you to get a sense of how much you're paying for advice and what potential conflicts of interest may arise. And so the article that you mentioned, I had one line in there where I say that just like you may want to work with a personal trainer that's physically fit, you probably mm-hmm. would rather work with a financial advisor that actually has their finances in gear. And so I think it's totally fair game to ask prospective financial advisors about their finances. But with that said, I don't think it's necessarily fair to ask an advisor what their actual net worth is or what their gross salary is. I think actual net worth numbers could be misleading because you can't be sure whether the a high net worth is because of their own doing, you know, they're using the right strategies to manage their money, or is it because of some large inheritance? But I think it's more important for consumers to focus on the specific processes, strategies, and philosophies that a particular advisor has.
We are talking with Roger Ma. He is the founder of the New York City-based financial planning firm Life Laid Out. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a personal finance question for him or a money matter you would like to discuss with him. Or if you want to talk about AARP and benefits that you get from AARP. Roger told us, explained why he signed up for AARP at the age of 35. And so we thought we'd ask why you are a member, what benefits you get from it, too. Marissa in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Marissa.
Good morning.
Hi. What kind of benefit do you get from AARP?
I'm actually an insurance agent in Milwaukee, and a couple of my companies offer discounts on your home and auto insurance by being an AARP member, up to 5%.
Oh, so if I want insurance on my home or car, you will give me an AARP discount on it?
Correct.
And 5% of that is probably a pretty penny.
Depending on what your rates are, it could be pretty significant.
Yeah. So, Roger, there's another one. That's not a bad savings.
Not at all. I'll have to add that to the list.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Marissa. And again, we will welcome your questions for Roger at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org.
Money, 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 money. Money's on my mind.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is off this week. We are talking with financial planner Roger Ma, who is the founder of the New York City-based financial planning firm Life Laid Out. He's a contributor to Forbes and The Street. His website is lifelaidout.com. We welcome your personal finance question at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Randy in Madison is with us first. Hi, Randy.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Good. What is your question?
So I got a question from Mr. Ma. Mr. Ma, I've been shopping around for a financial consultant, and one of the consultants' kind of initial advice to me was, I've got two kids, two little ones, and his advice was, first thing you do is put aside about $70,000 to $80,000 before they turn seven into their college education saving account before you save for anything else. I just wanted to get your perspective on that.
Saving that much money before you save for anything else, Roger?
Hello, Randy. Yeah, I think what I would say about that is I usually advise consumers first to get an understanding of their entire financial situation. So before saving for your children's education, first making sure that you have an emergency fund in place, typically anywhere from 3 to 6 months of living expenses, but sometimes even more depending on the volatility of your job. And then the second thing that I would take a look at too is if you have any high interest debt right now, if so, then that might be the next thing to tackle And then the third thing that I would look at is whether you're currently taking advantage of your retirement plan at work and any employer matching or non-matching contributions. That would be, I think, the next most important thing to take care of before saving for your children's education. And in terms of what the actual amount you should have saved, I think that's really dependent on what school you think your children may go to. And I know that's really hard to come up with right now. But I think if you say, okay, my family is willing to fund public school for them, for maybe it's 100% or maybe it's 50%, and then from there you can start getting a sense of how many years you have and how much you'll have to save per year. And I think there's a site, savingforcollege.com, that has a lot of these great calculators for you to figure that out.
Okay, Randy?
Yep, thank you so much. Yep, I got all of that taken care of. So good, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Randy. Do you have just any general thoughts on, the way to save for college? That was laid out perfectly on sort of the priorities there for savings. But do education savings accounts or some other vehicle for that?
Yeah, I think 529 plans could be a great way to save for college education. And the way that these vehicles typically work is people are putting in after-tax money into this account. The money is invested and growing tax-deferred. And then when the money is taken out to fund a child's education, if it's used for qualified educational expenses, it will come out tax. The growth will come out tax-free. And so the benefit that people are really getting from this is the tax deferred growth, and then also it coming out, the gains coming out tax free. And I know for there's several states that do offer a state tax deduction for certain contributions, and I think Wisconsin is one of them that offers, I believe it's a little over $3,100 per beneficiary per year. So there's an additional incentive to save with your own state's 529 plan.
Let's go to Karen in Waukesha next. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My father passed in April, and I'm the executor of his will. And while working on wrapping up various parts of the estate, I finally got to the financial portion and learned that 3 days after my father's death, his advisor sold off all of his stock. No permission, no checking in with the executor. And I'm kind of weighing my different options about what I should do about this action that I believe is illegal.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Karen, first for your loss and then for this, but I don't know if Roger, if you're prepared to answer whether that's legal or not, but is that something that ever happens?
Yeah, I'm so sorry for your loss. That is probably out of my realm of expertise. But I would have you talked to the advisor about why they did that?
I have, and I haven't gotten an answer except that it was the best interest in the estate, of the estate.
It was in the best interest of the estate, and then they didn't give you any further information beyond that?
Correct. I'm still working on getting some information, but at this point that was the only statement I've received.
I would probably talk to a lawyer about this particular question.
Yeah. Thank you, Karen, for the call, and good luck. We are talking on this edition of On Your Money with Roger Ma, who is the founder of the New York City-based financial planning firm Life Laid Out. And we are talking about personal finance issues, and we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet it at Joy Cardine Show. Roger, we wanted to ask you about another piece you wrote about why our 401k employer match may not be free money after all. We're typically told that if the employer match is available, we should by all means take advantage of it. But before we get too far, as a rule of thumb, is making out the employer match, is maxing out, that a good strategy?
So I think whether an employer matches, provides a matching contribution or not to your 401k, I don't think that should dictate whether you should save for retirement and start saving early. I think it's important whether you're doing it through an employer plan or through a traditional IRA or Roth IRA to start saving early. I think what a lot of people say is traditional strategies are, oh, your employer matching contribution is like free money, and so you should contribute to your 401k before fulfilling any of your other financial goals. And I think my point of the article was it may not necessarily be free money. These 401k plans are a way for we have to remember they're a way for employers to attract and retain employees, and so at times there may be some strings attached. And what I mean by that is not only when you get the employer contribution throughout the year, but also there could be vesting schedules associated with employer contributions. And so on the employer contribution timing, the most generous 401k plans that I've seen match each pay period. But the least generous plans may match once a year at the end of the year. And so you can imagine if you contribute to your 401k in the beginning of the year thinking you're going to get your employer match, but then decide to switch jobs in the summer, well, you would be out of luck if your employer match contribution is just once a year at the end of the year. And so that free money wouldn't actually have come to fruition.
Yeah. You encourage people to do a 401k checkup in October. First off, why October?
I think October is a great time because you still have a couple of months to be able to increase contributions for the current year if you haven't maxed out to the $18,000, if that's what your goal is. And then also, it's a great time to evaluate perhaps what your monthly expenses are for the next year, because open enrollment happens for most companies around late October or early November.
That's right.
So you get a kill two birds with one stone.
Sure. Do we have a checklist? What are we going to be checking up on next month?
I think it's have I maxed out my 401k contribution? If not, perhaps increasing the amount that I'm contributing for the rest of the year so I can max out that contribution. And then I think for the following year, if you're not maxing out, taking a look at your monthly budget and cash flow and seeing how much that you're able to put in for next year. Maybe you can increase your percentage from 5% of your salary to 10% of your salary.
And you noted, though, that just because our company has deposited match monies into our account, that doesn't necessarily mean we'll be able to keep them. Explain that.
So the most generous plans I've seen allow employees to be vested in employer contributions immediately, but the least generous plans have vesting schedules associated with them. And in technical terms, these could be what they call cliff vesting or graduated vesting. And so what that means, what cliff vesting is a company might give you employer match contributions at the end of each year or each pay period, but you might not be fully vested in those contributions until the end of, let's say you've been there for 3 years. And so if you decide to leave jobs or switch jobs after 2 years, those employer match contributions will be taken back from you and forfeited. Another popular vesting schedule is the graduated schedule, where maybe a portion of those employer match contributions are vested over a period of as high as 6 years. And so one example, one could be getting being vested, let's say 20% in your employer match contributions per year. Now, they may be actually in your accounts, but in terms of if you actually own those and if are they yours free and clear, it might take 6 years for you to fully vest all those match contributions.
We will take some calls now. Denny in Spring Valley is with us. Hi, Denny.
Hi.
Yes, what's your question?
I'm wondering what's the most practical way to do this. I'm going to be 70 and a half, and I've got a TSP account with the federal government, and I'm asking myself if I should take it all out in cash or get the annuity starting next June. It's not a lot of money, but I'm not clear on what's the best route to take.
Roger, what's a TSP account?
So I believe that's equivalent to a 401k for government employees. Is that right, Danny?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and then I guess what I would ask is, are you retired?
Yeah.
Okay, and then do you have enough sources of funds from other areas, whether it's your taxable investment account or maybe other retirement accounts that you have?
I'm good for a couple years if everything were to collapse tomorrow. But, you know, my income level is low, but I've always been good at saving and live very simply, you know. So I'm pretty comfortable in that regard.
Okay. And then have you taken a look at the plan to see how, I guess, what it's invested in and maybe how much, what type of investments and how much you're paying for those investments?
I'm done paying for all of it because I'm retired from the federal government, but the annuity is not very large if I were to get it per month for the rest of my life. And then I think I'm taxed for the whole amount if I were to pull it out, you know, like in cash.
Right. And so, yeah, I think some of the things that I would think about is, I guess what you're, the need for the money right now, what's your tax bracket now versus if you took the annuity and incurred the tax over a period of time. So if you don't need the money now, so for example, let's say that you're on the cusp between two different tax brackets, and if you cashed out on this at 70 and a half, it would push you into a higher tax bracket. I guess I would think about that versus, let's say that you did take the annuity per year and were getting taxed on a smaller portion, but then getting taxed at a lower amount each year.
I see what you mean, yeah.
Good luck, Denny. Thanks very much for the call. We have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll get some tips on saving money on your grocery bill, and we will have time for more of your personal finance questions. Be they on saving money or investing for retirement or for education or for paying off student loans, whatever the case may be, your question is welcome at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is off this week. He will be back next week, and I know that he's going to have more retirement tips for me next week. Roger Ma is our guest this week. He is a financial planner as well. He is founder of the New York City-based financial planning firm Life Laid Out. He's a contributor to Forbes and The Street. His website is lifelaidout.com. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
Every time it rains, and it's from heaven.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Roger Ma, who is here to answer your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Before we go back to the phones, though, Roger, CNN Money quoted you in a story about saving money on your grocery bill. It said that you use an online grocery service almost exclusively. Tell us why that is.
So I use it. First of all, there's a lot of grocery stores in New York City that have been closing. Mm-hmm. But I use it to be able to save money and time. And so on the money part, I didn't see that big of a difference between shopping via this online service, Fresh Direct, or shopping at a physical grocery store. And then from a time perspective, I'm able to typically multitask, whether I'm at work or watching TV and just quickly fill up my grocery bag and get that ordered.
Yeah.
So it's much less friction than actually having to physically go to the grocery store, look around, and it takes much less time.
I can imagine, but don't you want to inspect the products before you buy them?
So I tested out this service for a couple of months, and I was pretty satisfied with the quality of meats and vegetables and the non-perishables as well, and really surprised actually at how they're able to maintain everything. So, for example, eggs is one item that is easily broken. But over the last 4 or 5 years that I've been ordering from them, I've only had eggs broken just a couple of times. So I've been pretty impressed at how they actually package things to you.
Yeah. So. Because I'm such a newbie at this, how does that work? So you go to the grocery store itself or a specific service that does this for you, and then you say I need bread and milk and eggs and it's delivered promptly, or how does that work?
Oh, so exactly. So I go to their website, freshdirect.com, and I just search for whatever item that I need for the week. What they also allow you to do is, if there are certain recipes that you make pretty frequently, let's say a pasta dish or a chicken dish, you can make shopping lists for those specific ingredients. And so instead of having to search for each individual item every time you want to make a certain recipe, it will be saved in your shopping list. And so you can really just do 1 to 2 click shopping, add everything to your shopping bag, and if there's certain staples that you have already, such as salt or pepper, you can remove those with one click, and then check out. And the other thing that I like about it is, usually they charge $5.99 delivery fee,
mm-hmm.
but they offer you the option to be able to get this delivery pass, where you pay an upfront fee to get unlimited deliveries for 6 months or a year. And so what my wife and I used to do is, to be able to save on the $5.99 delivery fee, we would plan out all our meals for the week on Sunday and get a big delivery. But inevitably, life happens during the week. We might go out spontaneously or not use all of our groceries. And what we found is that oftentimes we were wasting a fair amount of groceries at the end of the week. And so the power of this delivery pass is, we're able to order maybe 3 times a week. We'll order on Sunday for Monday and Tuesday. We might order in the middle of the week, and then we might order at the end of the week, too. And I think that allows us to increase the likelihood that we're actually going to use the groceries that we order.
Yeah, I have to admit, sometimes I will do that too, or I don't order, but I'll buy. Everything looks so good that I'll buy all this stuff, and then especially perishables are gone because I didn't really plan. So what else do you do to keep your grocery bill down?
So I typically shop from they have a weekly sale circular, just much like a physical grocery store, and typically we will plan our meals around what's on sale. And I think the other thing that we used to do, but we recently changed, was we used to get everything from the grocery store. So we'd get meat, vegetables, but then also toiletries as well, such as toilet paper, paper towels, toothpaste. But what I started realizing is a lot of these grocery stores have much higher prices on those toiletry items than some other stores, such as a Walmart or Amazon.com. And so we've started to exclusively get groceries from the online delivery service, but then go elsewhere for our toiletries. And I think we've saved a significant amount of money just by doing that.
Yeah. I know this is just underway now, but any thoughts on Amazon acquiring Whole Foods? So now it might not – is that going to be cheaper than Whole Foods if we do it via Amazon?
So it was pretty interesting. I think Bloomberg had come out with an article last week or a couple weeks ago doing a price comparison actually at the Whole Foods nearest to me, and they're showing some of the savings before and after Amazon took over. And one example they gave was a whole rotisserie chicken that I think used to be $13.99 and got marked down to $9.99. Mm. And then there were some other savings as well, such as avocado, bananas, et cetera. And so I think what Amazon said is that's just the beginning. So it will be interesting to see how those prices stack up with other grocery stores. For us specifically, I don't know if Whole Foods delivers, but there is a service called Instacart, I think, that has partnered with Whole Foods where you can order online on Whole Foods, and then this Instacart service will deliver to you. And so that's something that I've certainly thought about, whether if Whole Foods has lower prices, combined with a delivery fee off the pay Instacart, whether that's cheaper than what I'm doing right now.
We are talking with Roger Ma, who is the founder of the New York City-based financial planning firm Life Laid Out. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a personal finance question for him. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Pete in Bellevue, Iowa next. Hi, Pete.
Hi, great to talk to you guys. Just wondered if there are any social investment index funds, let's say staying away from military or petroleum industries. Is there anything like that that someone can do someone on their own? Does Vanguard, Fidelity, anyone have index funds that are socially more responsible that way?
Did you get that, Roger?
I did get that. I'll be honest, I'm not as familiar with the social investing, but I think Vanguard may have a social index fund that you'd be able to invest in yourself.
Yeah. Dude, I mean, just have general thoughts on that as to whether, I mean, do any of your clients want to be socially responsible investors and avoid certain, you know, industries?
So we have, it hasn't come up with my clients as much. We typically invest in low-cost passive index funds for them, and then if they want to be able to make an impact elsewhere, then we'll talk about how to efficiently or effectively donate money to some causes. And so one of the things that I'll use with my clients is a vehicle called a donor-advised fund. And I think that that's a very interesting vehicle, and it is a good time to be able to start thinking about that. And the benefits of that are you're able to put some money into this fund right now and get the tax benefit today, but you can think about how you actually allocate that money to charities sometime in the future. And while you're thinking about that, the money is invested, so there's potential for it to grow. And the other thing that I like about these donor-advised funds is you're able to donate appreciated securities. And so instead of cashing out on a security and having to pay the capital gains, you can donate a security that's appreciated a fair amount in value, get the tax benefit on that, and then to be able to make an impact that way. That's typically how I've done it with my clients.
Let's go next to Mike in Cambridge. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I was wondering, my wife is retired. I'm going to retire in the next year. And we have three different accounts. She has a 401k. I have an IRA. And then we have a SEP account through work. And I'm just wondering down the road if we could combine all of them. So when we turn 70 and a half, we only have to take our minimum distribution out of one account instead of all three.
So can a husband and wife combine, Roger?
So the husband and wife can't combine. Yeah. So is the SEP IRA for you specifically?
Yes.
Okay. So I believe you can combine that SEP IRA with your traditional IRA, but you wouldn't be able to combine it with your wife's 401k. And certainly if your wife is still working and when she retires she wants to roll that over into her own IRA, that's something that she can do as well.
Yeah, but then you still have to take a minimum requirement out of that at 70 and a half.
Yep, exactly. So the required minimum distributions will be separate for each of you. And so it'll be based on the balance that you have in your SEP IRA and your traditional IRA, and then your wife's will be based on the balance that she has in her 401k.
Thank you, Mike. Good luck to you and your wife. Before we wrap up, Roger, I wanted to ask you about another piece that you were quoted in. It was in the Mike, and it said that getting rich isn't about winning the lottery or making brilliant investments. It's more of a lifestyle than a get-rich-quick scheme. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think the formula is actually quite easy to build wealth. It's either increasing the money that you're bringing in, whether it's through increasing your salary or coming up with a side hustle to make additional income, or trying to decrease expenses, or the people that I've seen most effectively build wealth do a combination of both, where they're able to increase their salary and decrease expenses at the same time. And I think that's oftentimes the reason that you'll see the headlines in the papers where it says, oh, this lottery winner is now bankrupt, or they lost all their money. Just simply getting a lot of money doesn't mean you're going to be able to maintain or build that wealth. I think the most important thing, and this is what I tell young people a lot, I think saving money and building the right strategies early on will make the biggest impact. And then there is some inflection point when once you have enough money saved, the investment part or growing that money becomes more important. And so the way that I break it down to my clients is saving, growing, and making sure to protect your money along that journey as well.
Yeah, very, very briefly, how do you recommend we land a higher salary?
Well, I think part of that is finding work that you like to do. And I know, especially for young people coming out of college, they might be in the exploration phase. And so taking the time often to reflect on what your skills are and how that aligns with being compensated well. But I think generally, if you find a role or if you find work that you like to do, you're going to naturally be better at it and in the long term be compensated better for it.
Yeah. Well, we just have a minute to go. What are you working on now or writing about next?
So I have an interesting piece next on, again, I'm always I'm trying to demystify the financial planner market for consumers. So I have a fun piece on a couple of reasons why Doc Brown from Back to the Future would have made a terrible financial planner.
I'll look forward to seeing that. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Roger Ma is the founder of the financial planning firm Life Laid Out. He's a contributor to Forbes and The Street. His website is lifelaidout.com. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be back next week. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.